If I talked about it, I would want to scream, and this coat was too tight around my ribs for that. It was the same reason I now avoided Aija and Sifa, always together these days, and consulting with exiles about the future almost hourly. I couldn't bear the feeling. In light, short strokes, with pauses as my current gift swelled and receded like a tide, I lined Tekka's eyelid with black, using the other end of the pencil to smudge it. When I first met her, she would have stabbed me rather than let me get this close to her, so though she would deny it if I asked, I knew she was softening toward me, as I had already softened toward her. A soft heart was a gift, whether given easily or with great reluctance. I would never take it for granted again. She opened her eye. Its blue looked even more brilliant with the black to frame it. She wore what she called her fancy eye patch on the other eye. It was clean and black, and held to her face with ribbon instead of a stretchy band. "There," I said. "Almost painless." She looked at herself in the mirror. "Almost," she agreed. But she left the pencil in place, so I knew she liked it. I tried not to think about Akos, or dream about him, or imagine conversations we might have had about what I was experiencing. I was already barely containing my rage at Thuva. I didn't need something to stoke the flames further. On the flight to Pokgo, however, I allowed myself just a moment of weakness before reprimanding myself. As the ship glided between tall buildings, built higher than any of the ones in Voa, so tall they might have scraped the bottom of the Shissa ones that fell, I pictured the look of wonder his face would have worn if he had seen it. And I would have said something like, "Ogryn's allowed a certain percentage of trees to be preserved when they built Pokgo, which is why it still looks like a forest below us." He would have smiled, amused as always by the knowledge I kept filed away, but not amused enough by me to give me a damn explanation before. "Stop," I told myself, blinking tears from my eyes. There was pain in my knees, hips, elbows, and shoulders, pain in all the spaces between my bones. I couldn't indulge this. There was work to be done. The ship docked at a building near the center of Pokgo, where all the buildings were so close together I could peer into strangers' offices and living spaces and see how they decorated them. Ogryn's favored excess, so most of them were packed with objects of personal significance or fine craftsmanship. Everyone seemed to have the same decorative boxes, made of polished wood with little patterns carved into them. When the hatch opened, I shuddered a little, because the wind that blew in was strong, and it was clear we were higher up than I had realized, given the drop in temperature. Someone on the docking station guided a motorized walkway to the hatch. It had neither handrails nor some kind of visible failsafe to keep a person on top of it. Our Ogryn captain, a thick man with a substantial gut, walked right across it with the grace of a dancer. Issa followed, and I was close behind her, forcing my eyes up and focused on the open doorway that was my destination. If Akos had been here, I would have held his hand, my arm stretched out behind me like a banner. But Akos was not here. So I made it across alone. Ogryns were ruled by a pair of people, one a woman and the other Sima, the word in Shotet for neither woman nor man. There were two major political factions on Agra, I knew, one amenable to change and the other not. Each one presented a viable candidate every 10 seasons, and they ruled together, by compromise or by bargaining. It seemed impossible to me that such a thing could work, but apparently it wasn't, because the system had lasted 200 seasons so far. The Sima leader introduced themselves as Roka, and had close-cut hair the color of Urek sand, a dusting of freckles on their skin, and delicate, pursed lips. The woman, Lucia, she had called herself, as she gripped my arm in greeting, was taller, thicker, and several shades darker-skinned than I was. The pencil smeared above her lashes had a faint shimmer to it, lighting her eyes from above, and it suited her.
"You are Syra Noavec,"
Roka said to me, as we all stood in a group before the meeting was called to order. Lucia was talking to Issa and Aza behind me. I could tell because her hearty laugh kept filling my head with a mirth I couldn't feel. "Allegedly," I said, because I couldn't help myself. Roka laughed.
"You're taller than I thought," they said. "I suppose anyone looks short beside Rizek Noavec."
"Looked," I corrected them. To me it was just a grammatical error, a courtesy to someone who didn't speak Xotet as a native. But their face tightened in recognition of the insensitivity.
"My apologies," they said. "You lost him so recently."
"I wouldn't say I lost anything," I said. Roka raised an eyebrow. The freckles on their eyelids made me think of Akos, and a web of current shadows spread over my eye socket, making me wince.
"I can't tell if you are joking or not," Roka said.
"That should please you. Ogryns love mystery, don't they?" I replied sourly, and Roka squinted at me, as if puzzled, as Lucia called the meeting to order.
"Let us speak plainly," Lucia said, and Roka snorted.
Lucia wrinkled her nose at them, like a child might at a sibling. She was the more traditional of the two Ogryn leaders I knew, so she had a tendency to pontificate and stand on ceremony. I suppressed a laugh as Roka winked at me across the low table. We sat on stools around it. The heavy fabric that covered me from throat to ankle pooled around me, glinting with the luminous thread that held it together. "Then, plainly speaking, we are surprised that Agra would even consider expelling us when we have coexisted comfortably for so long on this planet."
"We would not consider it if the pressure were merely coming from Thuva," Lucia said with a sigh. "But Thuva is backed by the Assembly, and they are seeking powerful alliances. Our intelligence reports the Chancellor is on her way to Othir at this very moment."
I glanced at Tekka. She looked as troubled as I felt, her mouth drawn down toward her chin. If Thuva made an alliance with Othir, this war was effectively over. No one would stand against Othir, not without a cause greater than keeping Xotet from being obliterated. As far as I knew, Othir had always been the wealthiest and most powerful planet in the galaxy. It had been, at one time, rich with natural resources, but as our race advanced, they turned to more intellectual pursuits than mining or farming. Now they developed technology and conducted research. Nearly every advance that had been made in the field of medicine, space travel, food technology, or personal conveniences had come out of Othir. If a planet were to cut itself off from Othir, it would lose access to the things we had all, Xotet included, come to rely on. A leader would be mad to risk it.
"Why is the Assembly backing Thuva instead of maintaining neutrality, as they have in the past? Suddenly this is no longer a civil dispute, as they've been insisting for over 10 seasons?
Tekka said.
"They sense that we are vulnerable," Aza replied. "They undoubtedly see this as a cleanup effort. Get rid of Xotet trash. Blast it into space."
I relished the anger in Aza's voice, so similar to my own.
"That may be a slight exaggeration," Lucia chastened. "The Assembly would surely not engage in a conflict unless they thought..."
"Then tell me why," Aza's voice shook as she interrupted Lucia. Tell me why an attack against innocents fleeing to the sojourn ship in Voa was not considered a war crime when an attack against innocents in Shissa was. Is that not because Thuvazit children are considered innocent and Shotet children are not? Is it not because Thuvazit people are considered productive and the Shotet are characterized as brutal scavengers?
I thought you didn't support Lazmet Noavek's actions against Thuva, Roka said, voice hard. You issued a statement condemning the attack immediately upon hearing about it, after all.
And I stand by that statement. Lazmet Noavek has recruited himself an army composed of supporters of his late son. His actions against Shissa had nothing to do with us, and we certainly would not have done something so cruel, Aza said. But that doesn't mean that Thuva doesn't deserve some kind of retribution for what they did to us.
I didn't have to be an expert in these kinds of meetings to know this one wasn't going well. The preferred communication style for an Ogryn was like a hammer hitting a nail, and it was the same for Shotet. In fact, our cultures had more in common than not. We valued resilience, we occupied planets that defied us, we revered the oracles. If I could make them see how connected we were, maybe they would agree to help us.
Why do they hate us? I said, head tilted. I pitched my voice high so it would sound like I was genuinely confused.
What do you mean, why? Aza scowled at me. They have always hated us. Their hatred is without basis, without foundation.
No hatred is mindless, not according to the mind of the one who hates, Tekka said, nodding at me. They hate us because they think we are backward. We follow the current stream. We honor the oracles.
And the oracles, by naming the Noavek family's fates, have affirmed Shotet's place in the galaxy, I said.
But the Assembly didn't listen. The Assembly didn't grant us sovereignty. They want to limit the Oracle's power, not magnify it by honoring the fates. And so they hate us for revering the very people from whom they want to wrest power.
That is a bold claim, Lucia said. Treasonous, some might say, to suggest that the Assembly wants to strip the Oracles of their power.
The only treason I acknowledge, I said, is treason against the Oracles. And I have never once committed that crime. The same cannot be said of our governing body.
Aza said, 2 seasons ago, Agra was on the verge of war because the Assembly wanted to release the fates of the fated families to the public, was it not?
I read the transcript. You yourself, Lucia, seemed particularly angry about their choice.
I didn't see a reason to break our traditions, Lucia said stiffly.
That act, Tekka said, of needlessly declaring all the fates to the general public resulted in the kidnapping of an oracle of our planet and culminated in the very war that we're in right now. The Assembly sowed the seeds for this war by defying the oracles. And now they want to crush us because of it?
I didn't know if she was making any headway. I wasn't good at reading faces. Nevertheless, she persisted.
The Assembly is threatened by any planet that is fate faithful, Tekka said. It started with us, but don't think it will end with us. Tepes, Zold, Asander, Agra, all the fate faithful planets are at risk. If they can call us backward and orchestrate a war to get rid of us, they can do it to you. We all have to stand together if we want to keep their power limited, as it should be.
I tried to read Roka and Lucia's body language. I was not so poor at that, but it was difficult without understanding Ogryn culture better. Roka's hands were folded neatly on the table in front of them. Lucia's arms were crossed. Surely not a good sign in any culture. I cleared my throat.
I have an idea, before we even get that far.
Everyone turned toward me, Tekka with her mouth puckered.
I have met Issei Benazit, Chancellor of Thuva. She spent days with Shotet renegades when she was in Voa. She just sent someone to Agra to talk about an alliance. She knows that we are not the same as Lazmet Noavek. I lifted my shoulder. It's not Shotet that's the problem for her. It's the current regime. And we are in agreement on that point.
First you say it's the Assembly waging this war, and then it's just Issei Benazit?
Lucia demanded.
Which is it?
It's both, I said. The Assembly is using Issei Benazit for a reason. They want to follow the law. They won't attack without cause. So if Thuva won't attack us, the Assembly has no intermediary through which to wage war. The conflict dissipates. Appease Issei, and we appease the Assembly. Unseating Lazmet would appease Issei.
Let me guess, Tekka said. Your proposed solution is to kill him.
I wasn't sure how to answer, so I didn't try.
You know of X, she said, always eager to draw blood.
I refuse to choose a complicated solution just because it leaves my hands clean, I snapped.
I have been urging you all to take Lazmet Noavek seriously since his face first appeared on screens across the galaxy. He is powerful, and he holds half of Shotet in his fist. If he is dead, we can reclaim our people and negotiate a peace. Until he is dead, peace will be impossible. I was sitting like my mother, I realized. Back straight, hands folded, legs crossed at the ankles. Perhaps she was not my mother by blood, but I carried more of her in me than I carried of the Oracle who had traded me for the sake of fate. I had not ceased to be a Noavek. It was not often a comfort, but in this situation, where strength was required, I did not disparage it. Roka bobbed their head a few times.
I think there is a solution here that suits all of us, they said. Miss Noavek, since this is your idea, we will arrange for you to propose your solution to Chancellor Benazit herself, on a secure feed. In the meantime, we will open discussions, Shotet and Agra both, with Tepes, Zold, and Esander, just to explore our options. Lucia?
Discussions only, Lucia said,
jabbing the table in front of her with one finger.
Covert ones. We don't want the Assembly to think we are planning some kind of rebellion.
We can send our envoys on delivery vessels as they exit the planet's atmosphere, Aza said. The Assembly hardly pays attention to Agra to begin with. They won't be checking your flight ledgers.
Fair, Lucia said. We are agreed, then. Miss Noavek, we will arrange for you to speak to the Chancellor of Thuva within a week.
I felt my pulse in my fingertips. I needed time. More time than I could ask for. More time than they could give me. And even with time, could I really plan to assassinate my own father? Could I even do it successfully, given what had happened when I made the attempt on Rizek's life? If you can't do it, no one can, I reminded myself. If you can't do it, we're done for anyway. So you may as well try. When I stood, it was on steady feet and with steady hands. But I felt anything but steady.
Chapter 32 Syra. Tekka and I returned to the small apartment to which Aza had assigned us. It was a single room, with a stove half as wide as the one I had used on the sojourn ship. I thought of its permanent splatters with a sharp pang that made me hesitate with my jacket buttons, and a bathroom we couldn't both stand in at the same time. Still, there was a little desk where I read late at night, when Tekka turned away from the light. She kept tools and wires and computer parts in a box in the corner, and built little things in her spare time, little remote control vehicles with wheels, or a hanging ornament that sparked when the wind blew. She stripped off her jacket as soon as we were through the door, and tossed it on the bed, its sleeves inside out. I was more careful with mine, undoing each metal button with both hands. The luminous thread was stitched around each buttonhole, keeping it from tearing. A finely made thing it was, and one I hoped I would get to keep. Tekka was over at my desk, touching her fingers to the page I had left open with a notebook beside it.
"The family Karaseth is one of the oldest of the Faded families, arguably the first, though they have never expressed much interest in debating that point. Their fates rarely, if ever, guide them toward leadership positions, but rather to sacrifice, or, more mysterious still, seemingly unremarkable destinies."
Tekka frowned.
"Are you translating this from Ogryn yourself?"
I shrugged. "I like languages."
"Do you speak Ogryn?"
"I'm trying to learn it," I said. "Some scholars say it's more poetic than most languages, has more rhyming or near-rhyming sounds. I prefer Shotet for poetry, personally, because I don't enjoy rhymes, but..." She was staring at me.
"I do enjoy the challenge of it." "What?" "You're odd," she said. "You just built a little machine that makes chirping sounds," I said. "And when I asked you what it was for, you said, 'chirping sounds.' And I'm the one who's odd?"
Tekka smiled a little.
"Fair."
Her gaze returned to the book. I knew she was about to ask me why I was translating the section about the Karaseth family, and maybe she knew that I knew too, because she never actually asked the question.
"It's not what you think. I'm not looking into them because of him," I said. "It's..." I hadn't told anyone what Vara said to me. My Karaseth blood seemed like a secret that ought to be kept. After all, it was the Noavek name that made me useful to the exiles now. Without it, they might dispose of me. But I had committed worse crimes in front of Tekka than having the wrong name, and she was still here. In the past, the idea of trusting another person would have terrified me. But I didn't feel that fear now.
"The Oracle told me something," I said. And I told Tekka the story.
"Okay, so you're telling me it doesn't bother you at all that Akos ended up being attracted to someone who shares genes with a person he believed to be his sister and mother?"
Tekka was flopped on the floor, cracking the shells of some kind of Ogryn nut, roasted to get rid of its poisonous qualities, of course, with her fingernails.
"I'll say it one more time," I said. "He and I are not related at all in any way."
I was leaned up against the side of the bed, my arms draped over my bent knees.
"Whatever," Tekka said. "Well, at least you aren't actually planning to commit patricide, then, since Lazmet isn't actually your father."
"You're really fixating on the blood relationship thing," I said. "Just because we aren't technically related doesn't mean he's not my father. And I say that as someone who would really like for him not to be my father."
"Fine, fine," she sighed. "We should probably start planning this whole assassination thing, if you have less than a week before you're talking to Issei."
"We?" I raised my eyebrows. "I'm the one who volunteered for this stupid mission, not you."
"You're obviously going to need my help. For one thing, can you even fly yourself back to Thuva?"
"I can fly a ship.
through Agra's atmosphere? I don't think so.
Okay, I said. So I need a pilot.
And a ship.
And you need to find out where Lazmet is, and get in, unseen, and figure out how you're going to kill him, and then how you're going to get out afterward.
She sat up and popped the flesh of the nut, stripped of its shell, into her mouth. Tucking it into her cheek, she said,
"Face it, you need help, and you're not going to get many volunteers yourself. You may have observed, the exiles aren't exactly wild about you."
"Oh, really?" I said flatly. I hadn't noticed.
"Well, they're stupid that way," Tekka said, flapping her hand at me. "I'll get you the people you need. They like me."
"Can't imagine why." She threw the broken shell at me, hitting me in the cheek. I felt better than I had in a long time. Later that night, after hours of talking ourselves in circles about the assassination plan, Tekka fell asleep fully clothed in her bed. I cleaned up the shells, which now covered the floor, and sat at the Book of Fated Families to resume my translation. The sight of the word Karaseth, written in Ogryn, sparked heat behind my eyes. I picked up my pen, pausing every few seconds to wipe tears from my eyes, or snot from my nose. I had pretended with Tekka that I was translating this section of the book to learn more about my own family, that it had nothing to do with Akkos. But the unfortunate truth was that I was still in love with him.
Chapter 33, Akkos. A few seasons ago, he'd been dragged into the city of Voa by soldiers of Rizek Noavik, badly beaten, with his scared brother at his heels. The warm, dusty air had choked him. He hadn't been used to crowds, or the loud laughs of people gathered around food stalls, or all the weapons tapped casually in the middle of conversation like they didn't matter. Now he walked with his palm balanced on the knife sheathed at his waist, without thinking much of it. He had tied a cloth around his nose and mouth, and cropped his hair close to his head to keep from being recognized by the wrong people. But it didn't seem likely he would be. Most of the people he passed were too focused on getting where they were going to give him more than a quick glance. There weren't crowds in the streets anymore. Those who were walking did it with heads down, their bags tucked close to their sides. Soldiers dressed in armor stamped with the Noavik seal walked the streets. Even the poorer ones at the edge of the city where Akkos had gotten off the small transport vessel that had carried him here. Half the little shops were boarded up or had their doors chained shut. There had obviously been some looting and vandalism in the wake of Rizek's death. Not surprising, but things seemed under control now. Too much control, with Lazmet sitting on the throne. Akkos was getting to know his way around Voa, at least the part of Voa that Ara, Jorek's mother, and Jorek lived in. If the city was arranged in concentric circles around Noavik Manor, Ara and Jorek lived with Ara's brother in one of the middle rings, the perfect place to disappear. The apartments were crowded together, each one a different style, with a door in a different place, forming a maze. Akkos had stumbled into two courtyards that morning when he left, and had to backtrack to where he started each time. Ara had sent him to the market to search out flour for her baking, and he'd come up empty. The market had a news feed in one of the stalls, so he'd gone to see if there was any word about Agra. He'd left Agra without saying anything to Syra, knowing it would make her hate him. That was the point. If she hated him, she wouldn't look for him. She would assume he had gone back to Thuva and leave him be. Akkos had to keep forcing his attention back to the path he was walking instead of what was around him. He passed by a line of people so long he couldn't see what they were waiting for until two blocks later, when he saw a run-down office with the Shotet character for medicine above it, a health clinic. Down an adjacent alley, two kids fought over a bottle of something Akos didn't recognize. A lot of people had been hurt in the attack, and basic supplies like antiseptic or silver skin were limited. Loved ones were always waiting at health clinics lately, in the hope they might inch closer to what they needed. Still others bought black market cures that either didn't do anything or made things worse. Ara and her family had, fortunately, been untouched by the blast. Akos spotted the wall of graffiti he used as a landmark. The colors were bright, most of the symbols still unintelligible to him, though he recognized the one for Noavek, standing out in the center. He tapped on the wooden door just past it, looking left and right to make sure he was alone. He could still hear the scuffling of the kids in the alley behind him. Ara's brother's house was packed with junk, like a lot of Shotet houses were, all the furniture pieced together from other things. The drawer handles in the kitchen were made of floater parts, and the knobs on the oven were claw grips from the toy robots Shotet children battled with. Sitting at the low table on the other side of the room was Ara Kuzar, a bright blue shawl around her shoulders, and Jorek. He had let a full beard grow in on his face, patchy in places, and he wore armor with the seal of Noavek under his shoulder. He looked worn, but he still gave Akos a smile when he walked in. "I'm sorry, Mrs. Kuzar. No flour," Akos said to Ara. "No news from Agra either. I think the Noavek propaganda machine is going strong." "This affectation of calling me Mrs. Kuzar was cute at first," Ara said wryly. "But it's getting downright alarming. Sit. You need to eat something." "Sorry," he mumbled, sitting across from Jorek. He pulled the scarf down around his neck and ran a hand over his shorn hair, still surprised at how short it was. It was prickly in the back. "How's the manor?" "Boring," Jorek said. "I saw the side of Lazmet's head today. Most of the upper-level guards are stationed near Rizek's secure rooms. You know, the ones Syra's blood couldn't get us into. But he walked through the back door today." Akos logged that information away, along with everything else he'd heard about Lazmet since getting to Voa, which wasn't much. He was a myth in people's minds more than a man, so what they knew sounded like legends and folk tales instead of facts. "At least I don't have to fight in Thuva or anything," Jorek said. "Not that I would. That attack was..." He shook his head. "Sorry. Don't mean to bring it up." Akos tucked a hand into his pocket and took out a strip of dried hushflower petal. He was chewing them more than he should these days. He would run out soon, but the tension in his jaw and shoulders was giving him headaches, and he needed to be able to think if he wanted to face what was next. He was here, in Voa, to kill Lazmet Noavek, and it wouldn't be easy. "There's something I need to talk to you about," Akos said. "I was wondering when you'd get to the point," Jorek said. Ara set a plate down in front of Akos. There wasn't much on it. A roll, probably a little stale by now. Some dried meat, some pickled salt fruit. She brushed the crumbs off her fingers and sat down next to her son. "What Jorek means is, we like having you here, but we know you don't do things without a good reason," Ara said, flicking the side of her son's nose to chastise him. "And crossing the galaxy is no small thing." Jorek rubbed his nose. "Not everyone can wait things out on Agra. Some of us have to get our hands dirty," Akos said. "But those who can stay safe should," Ara said. Akos shook his head. "I had to get my hands dirty, too. Call it fate." "I call it a choice," Jorek said, "and a dumb one. Like leaving your girlfriend and your mother and brother without a word of explanation," Ara said, and she clicked her tongue. My mother and brother don't need me to leave word to know where I am. And this is how things are between Syra and me, Akko said, defensive. She plotted for weeks to send me away without telling me about it. How is this different? It is not particularly different, Ara said, but that doesn't make it right either time. Don't scold him, Mom, Jorek said. He was basically born scolding himself. Scold me all you like, Akko said. Especially because I'm about to ask for something you won't like. Jorek's arm snaked across the table, and he stole some meat from Akos's plate. I want you to let me into the back gate of Noavek Manor, Akko said. Jorek choked on the meat he was now chewing, prompting Ara to thump him on the back with her fist. What are you going to do once you're inside? Ara said, narrowing her eyes. It's better if you don't know, Akko said. Akos, trust me. Even you, pupil of Syra Noavek, are out of your depth with Lazmet, Jorek said after he had swallowed his bite. There isn't a single shred of decency in him. I don't think he even has the capacity for it. If he finds you, he'll turn you into a goddamn stew. He won't kill me, Akko said. Why, because of your stunning good looks? Jorek snorted. Because I'm his son, Akko said. Ara and Jorek stared at him in silence. Akko pushed his plate across the table toward Jorek. Want my roll? He said. Chapter 34, Akko. Akko rid himself of the heavy robe he had worn to get there, tossing it in an alley. It would only slow him down past this point, and he was cloaked by night anyway. He kept his footsteps as quiet as he could as he crept along the high wall behind Noavek Manor. He still remembered staring out at this wall when he was a prisoner, teaching Syra to make painkillers. It had been his way out. Go through the hidden hallways, get to Aija, leave through the back gate, use the code Syra had showed him without meaning to. He could have pried open the locking mechanism himself and shoved his fingers inside, disrupting the current, but the risk of getting caught was too high. The guard changed too often, so instead he stood by the back door and waited for Jorek to open it. It had taken a lot of arguing to get Jorek to agree to this, not just with Jorek, but with Ara. They suspected, of course, what Akko was here to do, and they didn't want him to take the risk. They thought it was bravado, or stupidity, or downright instability. Eventually, it was the reminder of what Akko had done for Jorek that got him to agree. The ring that hung around his neck, and the precise mark on his arm. Jorek had owed him a favor. A big one. The heavy door opened a crack, showing a sliver of a man. Boots, armor, patchy facial hair, and a bright, dark eye. Jorek jerked his head to the side, beckoning, and Akko opened the door just wide enough to slip through. Once it closed behind him with a click, he knew he couldn't go back. So even though he halfway thought he'd lost his mind, he kept going forward. As agreed, Jorek got him to the kitchen. Akko found the edge of the wall panel that would let him into the manor's hidden passageways and pulled it back. The familiar musty smell washed over him, sending him into memory, terrified and desperately hopeful, with the toe of Ija's shoe catching on his heel. And then the little pool of heat in his gut as he followed a painted Syra to the Sojourn Festival, the one that told him he liked her, no matter how hard he pretended otherwise. Liked her, then loved her, then left her. Jorek pulled him into a hug, quick and firm, before leaving Akko alone in the dark passageway. He stopped at the corners where the walls split, feeling for the symbols he had learned from Syra. An X for a dead end, a circle with an up arrow for stairs going up, and a circle with a down arrow for stairs going down. A number for which floor he was on. He had gone this way when he went to free Aija, All he had to do was get to that part of the house again, and then he'd be near the gene-locked rooms that had confounded the renegades when they came here to kill Rizek. Syra's blood hadn't opened the locks, but Akos's would, if Vara wasn't screwing with them both. Akos got to the exit he'd taken when he got Aija out. He knew he was tripping the same sensors that had made his escape attempt fail on that fateful day, but it didn't really matter. He wasn't trying to go unnoticed here. He left the panel open behind him and walked past the door that had once been Aija's with a little shiver. Even in the dark, this part of the house was grand. Dark wood, almost black, on the floor and the walls. Light fixtures packed with fenzu, sedate now as they slept through the night. Decorative vases and sculptures made of warm metal or polished stone with veins of color running through it, or etched glass. He couldn't imagine running through these halls as a kid, skimming the wood paneling with his fingers. He probably wouldn't have been allowed to run, or touch walls, or fall on his brother laughing, or any of the things that had made his young years rich and warm. He got to the secure door that he was pretty sure led to Rizek's old bedroom, and held up his hand over the locking mechanism. His fingers were trembling. He stuck his hand in the lock, wincing as it pierced his finger, drawing blood. A click, and then the door opened. If there had been any doubt in his mind that he was a Noavec, it was gone now.
Chapter 35. Syra. It was, perhaps, not the best idea for Tekka to approach me during breakfast, before my brain had booted up. I was hunkered down over my bowl of grains and fruit, watching Aija. He sat two tables away, facing me, with his own plate of food in front of him. But there was something odd about him. He was poking at the grains with his spoon, picking out the darker ones and putting them in a line along the edge of his tray. When I first saw Aija a few seasons ago, snuffling in the weapons hall before my brother, he had been filled out and tall. He had looked sturdy, though not overweight. But this Aija was pecking at breakfast, and there were still hollows in his cheeks. Tekka said, "Why are you staring so hard at Karaseth?" She stood in front of me, partially blocking my view of the new oracle. I didn't look away, though, still watching Aija jab at his bowl. My mother told me once that she used to scold Rizek for being a picky eater, I said. He ate fruit, but little else. And no matter what she put in front of him, he found something to pick at. She hoped he would grow out of it, but... I shrugged. I don't think he ever really did. Okay, Tekka said. Did an Ogryn give you some Zofra venom? I've heard it addles the mind. No. It's nothing, never mind, I said. I looked up at her. You know, when you stand like that, you look even shorter. Shut up, Tekka said. I found you some volunteers. Come on over. I sighed and picked up my bowl. My boots were still untied, so the laces flapped with each footstep. Tekka led me to a table in the corner where two other people sat. Issa, and the man I had fought weeks ago, with the knot of hair on top of his head. Etrek.
Hey there, Scourge, he said to me.
He had the kind of face that didn't give away his age, skin smooth but not layered with the pudge of youth, dark eyes glittering with mischief. I didn't like him. No, I said to Tekka, I'm not working with this idiot.
My name is pronounced Etrek, he said, grinning.
Listen, it's not like you have a deep pool of applicants here, Tekka said to me. Etrek knows people in Voa who can get us whatever supplies we need, as well as give us a place to land.
And you? I said to Issa.
You're Ogryn. Why do you want to get mixed up in all this?
I am a good pilot, Issa said. As to why I want to be involved, well, I have lived among people affected by Losmet Noavek for several seasons now, and if there is something I can do to help defeat him at last, I will do it.
I looked them over. Tekka, her blonde hair made frizzy by the Ogryn humidity. Issa had glowing bracelets up to one elbow, and she had lined her eyes in luminous pencil, so they glowed oddly. Etrek waggled his dark eyebrows at me. Was this the crew I would march back into Voa with, triumphant? Well, it was the best I was going to get.
Fine, I said. When do we leave?
I'll check the launch schedule, but it had better be sometime this week, Tekka said. It'll take a few days to get to Urek. Once we're through the atmosphere, I can send a message to Jorik in Voa and get a better sense of the situation. And Etrek can reach out to his contacts. But we can't do any of that from here.
All right, I said.
Hold on, Etrek said. What qualifies you to be in charge of this mission anyway?
I'm better than you, I said. At everything.
Tekka rolled her eyes.
She knows the target, Trek. You want to charge into Voa to kill a man you don't understand or know at all?
Etrek shrugged.
Guess not.
Everybody take this week to do what you need to get done, Tekka said. I'll start getting the ship ready now. I might need a new gravity compressor, and I know we need food.
And, I said, thinking of what Issei had used to kill my brother, maybe some new kitchen knives.
Tekka wrinkled her nose, likely remembering the same thing.
Definitely.
Anyway, we might not be coming back, so I shrugged. Say your goodbyes.
You're just bursting with optimism, aren't you?
Etrek said.
Did you expect the person leading your assassination mission to be cheerful? I said. If so, I think you're in the wrong field.
I set my half-finished bowl of breakfast down and drew the knife at my hip instead.
I leaned across the table and pointed the blade at him.
And by the way, if you call me Scourge again, I will cut that stupid knot right off the top of your head.
Etrek licked his lips, considering my knife.
Okay,
he finally said.
Syra.
Chapter 36. Sizi. I watch our descent through Othir's puffy clouds like I'm even farther away than I am, drifting through space and looking down at the entire planet at once. I felt like this since Akos and I parted ways, halfway between Agra and Thuva. He didn't want to come with me back to Assembly headquarters, and I didn't much blame him, so I'd hitched myself to the next Assembly freighter at some moon outpost and let him take the autonav back home. Truth be told, I am jealous of him, puttering around our warm kitchen, stoking the burnstones in our courtyard stove. Ast comes to stand next to me, arms folded. We're on a big Assembly craft, the nice sleek kind they save for chancellors and regents and sovereigns. You can't see any of the ship's guts. They're all hidden behind panels made of a pale metal that looks almost white. I tripped earlier, and when I smacked my hand against a wall to steady myself, I left a handprint. Whose job is it to polish all the walls? I wonder. Ast and I are both dressed up as Issei could get us to go. I wear a dress with long sleeves, so I look Thuvasit, I figure, because Othirians aren't as determined to button everything up to the throat as we are, in a soft gray. Ast is in trousers and a shirt with a collar. The guide bot whizzes around his head, clicking so he can hear its location. Issei's doing it again, he says. Go fix her. I can't stop her all the time, I say. It's wearing me out. Since the attack on Shissa, Issei's been going over every single person who died in the attack on her screen. She keeps spitting facts at me, too. Shep Uldoth, 34. He was a father of two CZ. His wife died, too, so now the kids are orphans. As much as I told her she couldn't dwell on the lives lost forever, she didn't pull herself away. She said she liked the anger going through the names gave her. It reminded her of what she had to do. I'm pretty sure she's just tired of grieving for Ori and needs something else to focus on. But I don't say so.
I don't really care if you're worn out, Ast says coolly. You don't think this is wearing her out? It's more important that she be rested than you, you know.
I want to curse him out, but my current gift stops me. So I just ignore him until he storms off. The ship passes through the cloud layer, and I can't keep myself from stepping closer to the glass. I've never been to Othir before. Most of the planet's surface is covered with cities. There are a couple of big parks that cultivate the planet's wildlife. Feeble, most of it, which was why Othirians hadn't much bothered with it. But the rest is glass and metal and stone. Glass walkways stretch this way and that, connecting the buildings, and sleek little floaters, much nicer than the ones we flew in Thuva, dart in and out of metal tubes that control traffic. So it's hard to explain to myself, given all that synthetic chaos, why Othir is pretty. Maybe it comes down to the big blue sky, the sunlight gleaming on the buildings in gold, green, blue, and orange. Maybe it's the neat little parks that show all different colored flowers and trees. The best-looking plants from every other planet but this one. But there is something nice in how busy it is, a kind of cheerful productivity. I clasp my hands in front of me as I walk down the hall, so I don't brush any of the walls. Issei is sitting in a waiting room, perched on the edge of a gray sofa. A view of Othir shows through the floor-to-ceiling window, but she's not even glancing at it. Her eyes are fixed on the portable screen in her hands. Artis Seminis, 50 years old. She was visiting her kid in the hospital after surgery. Both of them are dead now. She shakes her head. A hospital, CZ. Why did they have to target a hospital? Because Lazmet Noavec is evil, I say. We knew that before, and we know it now, and we'll never forget it. I am filling the room with calming water, letting it lap up against her ankles, tap against her toes. He's not the only one who made it happen, she says. Every Shotet who went along with him and didn't stop it is to blame. We're landing, I say. She's not wrong, but the heat she says it with makes me nervous. I imagine wading up to my waist, dragging my fingers through the soft weight of water. When's the meeting? It's over dinner, I say. They don't like strict business meetings here, apparently. Wouldn't want to let a person focus on the issues at hand, she says. Gotta dazzle them into doing whatever you say instead. Exactly, I say. She sounds more like herself already. She gets up, sets the screen down, and crosses the little room to stand in front of me. Did Ast yell at you again? She says, brushing her fingers over my face. He seemed upset when he left. I don't know why he takes it out on you. I shrug. It's the best I can manage. I'll talk to him again, she promises. I trust you, and so should he, even if he doesn't like your current gift. It's not like I don't know when you're using it. I smile. She doesn't, of course, always know when I'm using it. But it's good that she thinks so.
Chapter 37, Akos. The room beyond the gene lock smelled like fruit. Akos let the door close behind him, breathing the acid sweetness. This wasn't Rizek's bedroom. It was an office, and the desk had some kind of peel on it, green and puckered, the source of the smell. Beside it was a dormant screen on top of a stack of paper. Books were stacked here and there with titles he mostly couldn't read, unless they were in Altherian. Those were all about history. The rug under his feet was thick and dense, comfortable to stand on. There were footprints pressed into it, back and forth like somebody had been pacing not too long ago. Growing in a pot in the corner was a little tree, its trunk the same dark color as the floorboards. A tree native to the band of forests north of Voa, its leaves robust and healthy. Akos felt a squeeze in his head, like he was getting a headache, and ignored it. He moved instead toward the map that hung on the wall behind the desk, a map of the solar system. Their planet was marked Urek instead of Thuva, so he knew it was a Shotet-drawn map. The lines were careful, precise, and faded to light sketch marks at the edges, marking the boundaries of where the Shotet had gone. They were wider than Akos expected. Somehow it had never really struck him that before the Shotet became scavengers and warriors, they had been explorers. He felt the squeeze in his head again and paused. He had heard something. A shift, maybe. Someone walking in another room, on another floor. No. Not a shift. A breath. An exhale. Akos drew his blade and whipped around, arm extended. Leaning against the wall behind him was a tall, thin, weathered man. Lazmet Noavec. "My current gift doesn't work on you," Lazmet said. Akos's mouth went dry. "No current gifts work on me," he forced himself to say, the first words he'd ever said to his father. Lazmet pulled away from the wall. He was holding a current blade of his own. As Akos watched, he balanced it on his palm and spun it, catching it by the handle. So Rizek had learned that little habit from his father then. "Is that how you got in here?" Lazmet said. Akos shook his head. Lazmet stepped closer, and Akos shifted to the side, keeping distance between them. He felt like he was in the arena again, fighting another man to the death. Only he was much less prepared for this fight than he'd been for the one with Voss or Suzao. He never should have come here. He knew that now. Just looking at Lazmet in person, empty behind the eyes, calm and faintly amused, there was something not right about him. Something Akos didn't understand. "Then I admit to some confusion because I'm the only person who can access these rooms," Lazmet said. "So I know that while someone might have let you into the manor, they could not have let you in here." "My blood got me in," Akos said. Lazmet's eyes narrowed. He came closer. Akos had run out of space behind him. So he shifted again, knife still outstretched. Lazmet eyed the blade curiously. He probably wasn't used to seeing a current blade without the black tails binding it to a person's hand. "I began to suspect, when my youngest child grew older, that she was not actually mine," Lazmet said quietly. "I thought maybe her mother had been unfaithful to me. But I see now that isn't the case. She was just the wrong child entirely." Akos didn't understand how he wasn't more shocked, more startled, at least. "What is your name?" Lazmet asked him, spinning his current blade. "Akos," Akos said. "That is a fine Shotet name," Lazmet said. I assume my wife chose it for you. I wouldn't know.